Maybe part of it is that skeptical sounds like cynical. Yet true skepticism is consistent with good manners, civil discourse, and friendly communications. Skepticism is about approaching the world by asking why things might not be true, rather than why they are true. It's a recognition that, while there is an objective truth, everything we believe about the world is not true. Thinking in Bets embodies skepticism by encouraging us to examine what we do and don't know, and what our level of confidence is in our beliefs and predictions. This moves us closer to what is objectively true. A productive decision group would do well to organize around skepticism. That should also be its communications guide, because true skepticism isn't confrontational. Thinking in Bets demands the imperative of skepticism. Without embracing uncertainty, we can't rationally bet on our beliefs, and we need to be particularly skeptical of information that agrees with us, because we know that we are biased to just accept and applaud confirming evidence. If we don't lean over backwards, as Richard Feynman famously said, to figure out where we could be wrong, we are going to make some pretty bad bets. If we embrace uncertainty and wrap that into the way we communicate with the group, confrontational dissent evaporates because we start from a place of not being sure. Just as we can wrap our uncertainty into the way we express our beliefs, I'm 60% sure the waiter is going to mess up my order, when we implement the norm of skepticism, we naturally modulate expression of dissent with others. Expression of disagreement is, after all, just another way to express our own beliefs, which we acknowledge are probabilistic in nature. Therefore, overtly expressing the uncertainty in a dissenting belief follows. No longer do we dissent with declarations of, "You're wrong." Rather, we engage by saying, "I'm not sure about that," or even just ask, "Are you sure about that? Or have you considered this other way of thinking about it?" We engage this way simply because that is faithful to uncertainty. Organized skepticism invites people into a cooperative exploration. People are more open to hearing differing perspectives expressed this way. Skepticism should be encouraged and, where possible, operationalized. The term devil's advocate developed centuries ago from the Catholic Church's practice during the canonization process of hiring someone to present arguments against sainthood. Just as the CIA has red teams and the State Department has its dissent channel, we can incorporate dissent into our business and personal lives. We can create a pod whose job, literally in business or figuratively in our personal life, is to present the other side, to argue why a strategy might be ill-advised, why a prediction might be off, or why an idea might be ill-informed. In so doing, the red team naturally raises the alternate hypotheses. Likewise, companies can implement an anonymous dissent channel, giving any employee from the mailroom to the boardroom a venue to express dissenting opinions, alternative strategies, novel ideas, and points of view that may disagree with the prevailing viewpoint of the company without fear of repercussions. The company should do its best to reward this constructive dissent by taking the suggestion seriously, or the expression of diverse viewpoints won't be reinforced. Less formally, look for opportunities to recruit a devil's advocate on an ad hoc basis. When seeking advice, we can ask specific questions to encourage the other person to figure out reasons why we might be wrong. That way, they won't be as reticent to challenge the action we want to pursue. We're asking for it, so it's not oppositional for them to disagree or give us advice contrary to what they think we want to hear. Make no mistake, the process of seeing ourselves and the world more accurately and objectively is hard and makes us think about things we generally avoid. The group needs rules of engagement that don't make this harder by letting members get away with being nasty or dismissive. And we need to be aware that even a softer serve of dissent to those who have not agreed to the truth-seeking charter can be perceived as confrontational. See David Letterman for details. Communicating with the world beyond our group. This chapter has focused primarily on forming truth-seeking groups on our own initiative or being part of such groups. Unless we have control over the culture around us, those of us more actively seeking dissent will generally be in the minority when we are away from our group. That doesn't mean that truth-seeking is off limits in those settings. It just means we have to take the most constructive, civil elements of truth-seeking communication and introduce them carefully. There are several ways to communicate to maximize our ability to engage in a truth-seeking way with anyone. First, express uncertainty. Uncertainty not only improves truth-seeking within groups, but also invites everyone around us to share helpful information and dissenting opinions. Fear of being wrong, or of having to suggest someone else is wrong, countervails the social contract of confirmation, often causing people to withhold valuable insights and opinions from us. If we start by making clear our own uncertainty, our audience is more likely to understand that any discussion that follows will not involve right versus wrong, maximizing our truth-seeking exchanges with those outside our chartered group. Second, lead with assent. For example, listen for the things you agree with, state those and be specific, and then follow with and instead of but. If there is one thing we have learned thus far, it is that we like having our ideas affirmed. If we want to engage someone with whom we have some disagreement, inside or outside our group, they will be more open and less defensive if we start with those areas of agreement, which there surely will be. It is rare that we disagree with everything that someone has to say. By putting into practice the strategies that promote universalism, actively looking for the ideas that we agree with, we will more naturally engage people in the process of learning with us. We will also be more open-minded to what others have to say as well, enhancing our ability to calibrate our own beliefs. When we lead with assent, our listeners will be more open to any dissent that might follow. In addition, when the new information is presented as supplementing rather than negating what has come before, our listeners will be much more open to what we have to say. The simplest rhetorical touches can make a difference. If someone expresses a belief or prediction that doesn't sound well calibrated, and we have relevant information, try to say and, as in, I agree with you that, insert specific concepts and ideas we agree with, and. After and, add the additional information. In the same exchange, if we said, I agree with you that, insert specific concepts and ideas you agree with, but, that challenge puts people on the defensive. And is an offer to contribute, but is a denial and repudiation of what came before. We can think of this broadly as an attempt to avoid the language of no. In the performance art of improvisation, the first advice is that when someone starts a scene, you should respond with yes and. Yes means you are accepting the construct of the situation. And means you are adding to it. That's an excellent guideline in any situation in which you want to encourage exploratory thought. The important thing is to try to find areas of agreement to maintain the spirit of partnership in seeking the truth. In expressing potentially contradictory or dissenting information, our language ideally minimizes the element of disagreement. Third, ask for a temporary agreement to engage in truth-seeking. If someone is offloading emotion to us, we can ask them if they are just looking to vent or if they are looking for advice. If they aren't looking for advice, that's fine. The rules of engagement have been made clear. Sometimes people just want to vent. I certainly do. It's in our nature. We want to be supportive of the people around us, and that includes comforting them when they just need some understanding and sympathy. But sometimes they'll say they are looking for advice, and that is potentially an agreement to opt into some truth-seeking. Even then, tread lightly, because people may say they want advice when what they really want is to be affirmed. This type of temporary agreement is really just a reverse version of the kind of temporary opting out that we did in my poker group when someone just had to vent about an especially intense, still raw loss. Flipping that on its head, it doesn't have to be offensive to ask, do you want to just let it all out, or are you thinking of what you want to do about it next? Finally, focus on the future. As I said at the beginning of this book, we are generally pretty good at identifying the positive goals we are striving for. Our problem is in the execution of the decisions along the way to reaching those goals. People dislike engaging with their poor execution. That requires taking responsibility for what is often a bad outcome, which, as David Letterman found out, will shut down the conversation. Rather than rehashing what has already happened, try instead to engage about what the person might do so that things will turn out better going forward. Whether it's our kids, other family members, friends, relationship partners, coworkers, or even ourselves, we share the common trait of generally being more rational about the future than the past. It's harder to get defensive about something that hasn't happened yet. Imagine if David Letterman had said, "It's too bad you have all these kooky people creating all that drama in your life. Have you thought about how you might get rid of all this drama in the future?" If Lauren Conrad had said something dramatic like, "I've got so many problems, I can't even think about the future," or "I'm stuck with these people, so there's nothing I can do about it," that obviously would be a good time to end the discussion. But the more likely result is that she would have engaged. And that focus on the future could get her to circle back to figure out why all the drama occurred. She wouldn't be able to sensibly answer the question about the future without examining the past. When we validate the other person's experience of the past and refocus on exploration of the future, they can get to their past decisions on their own. This is a good approach to communicating with our children who, with their developing egos, don't necessarily need a red pill shoved down their throats. A child isn't equipped to consent to the challenges of truth-seeking exchanges, but they can be nudged. I know, in The Matrix, Morpheus took Neo to visit the Oracle, and while waiting in the lobby, he saw children bending spoons with their minds and engaging in other precocious red pill behavior. But real-life kids are sensitive to feeling judged, and no real-life parent wants a kid with the ability to mentally send cutlery flying across the room. My son was an expert at fielding bad test scores as the teacher's fault. I had to be careful not to letterman him. Instead, I would tell him, "It must be hard to have a teacher like that. Do you think there's anything you can do to improve your grade in the future?" That at once provided validation and led to productive discussions about subjects like developing strategies for preparing for future tests and setting up meetings with the teacher to figure out what the teacher was looking for in assignments. Meeting with the teacher also created a good impression that would likely be reflected in future grades. Ultimately, even with our own kids' decisions, rehashing outcomes can create defensiveness. The future, on the other hand, can always be better if we can get them to focus on things in their control. These methods of communicating with people outside our truth-seeking group focus on future goals and future actions. When it works, they take a short trip into the future, beyond the frustrations of the present, and toward ways to improve things they can control. Accountability to a truth-seeking group is also, in some ways, a time travel portal. Because we know we will have to answer to the group, we start thinking in advance of how that will go. Anticipating and rehearsing those rational discussions can improve our initial decision-making and analysis at a time when we might not otherwise be so rational. That leads to the final decision strategy of this book: ways to use time travel techniques for better decision-making. By recruiting past and future versions of yourself, you can become your own buddy. Chapter 6, Adventures in Mental Time Travel. Let Marty McFly run into Marty McFly. Thanks to the success of the 3 Back to the Future movies, our go-to source on the rules of time travel is more likely to be Doc Brown than Dr. Stephen Hawking. The first rule, emphasized by the trilogy and repeated by nearly every time travel movie since, is whatever you do, don't meet up with yourself. Doc Brown, played by Christopher Lloyd, explains to Marty McFly, played by Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future Part 2, that the encounter could create a time paradox, the results of which would cause a chain reaction that would unravel the very fabric of the space-time continuum and destroy the entire universe. Granted, that's the worst-case scenario. The destruction might, in fact, be very localized, limited to merely our own galaxy. Don't meet up with yourself has become an unquestioned element of the quote-unquote science of time travel. In Time Cop, because, quote, the same matter can't occupy the same space at the same time, end quote, Jean-Claude Van Damme's character destroys the villain by pushing his past and future versions together. The villain turns into a liquefied blob and disappears from existence. In real-life decision-making, when we bring our past or future self into the equation, the space-time continuum doesn't unravel. Far from turning us into a liquefied blob, a visit from past or future versions of us helps present us make better bets. When making decisions, isolating ourselves from thinking about similar decisions in the past, and possible future consequences is frequently the very thing that turns us into a blob, mired by in-the-moment thinking where the scope of time is distorted. As decision makers, we want to collide with past and future versions of ourselves. Our capacity for mental time travel makes this possible. As is the case with accountability, such meetings can lead to better decisions. At the moment of the decision, accountability to our group can pop us briefly into the future to imagine the conversation about the decision we will have with that group. Running that conversation will often remind us to stay on a more rational path. Just as we can recruit other people to be our decision buddies, we can recruit other versions of ourselves to act as our own decision buddies. We can harness the power of mental time traveling, operationalizing it, encouraging it, and figuring out ways to cause that collision of past, present, and future as much as possible. Present us needs that help, and past us and future us can be the best decision buddies for the job. Poker players have unique decision challenges that get them thinking a lot about how to get this collision of past, present, and future self to occur at the moment of making a decision and executing on it. Because decisions in poker are made so quickly, players don't have the luxury of time in coordinating their rational, long-term strategic plans with their decisions at the poker table. And all those decisions made under severe time constraints have immediate consequences expressed as an exchange of poker chips. The constant exchange of chips reminds players that there is risk in every decision. Of course, the direction in which the chips flow in the short term only loosely correlates with decision quality. You can win a hand after making bad decisions and lose a hand after making good ones. But the mere fact that chips are changing hands is a reminder that every decision has consequences, that all those execution decisions you make along the way really matter. Away from the poker table, we don't feel or experience the consequences of most decisions we make right away. If we are winning or losing to a particular decision, the consequences may take time to reveal themselves. If we make a losing eating decision, like substituting snack wells for apples, there's no immediate outcome that lets us know there might have been a cost to that choice. If we repeat that kind of decision enough, there will be consequences, but they take time to play out. In business, if a leader ignores the ideas of an intern because what does an intern possibly know, it could take years for that intern to become a successful competitor before that mistake becomes obvious. If the trajectory of that business suffers because of the poverty of new ideas, the owner of the business might never realize the effect of that attitude. The best poker players develop practical ways to incorporate their long-term strategic goals into their in-the-moment decisions. The rest of this chapter is devoted to many of these strategies designed to recruit past and future us to help with all the execution decisions we have to make to reach our long-term goals. As with all the strategies in this book, we must recognize that no strategy can turn us into perfectly rational actors. In addition, we can make the best possible decisions and still not get the result we want. Improving decision quality is about increasing our chances of good outcomes, not guaranteeing them. Even when that effort makes a small difference, more rational thinking and fewer emotional decisions translated into an increased probability of better outcomes, it can have a significant impact on how our lives turn out. Good results compound. Good processes become habits and make possible future calibration and improvement. Those methods involve a lot of mental time travel, and those poker players could teach Marty McFly and Doc Brown a thing or two. Night, Jerry. For all the scientific research on the battle between our immediate desires and long-term goals, a particularly succinct explanation comes from Jerry Seinfeld on why he doesn't get enough sleep. I stay up late at night because I'm night guy. Night guy wants to stay up late. What about getting up after 5 hours of sleep? That's morning guy's problem. That's not my problem. I'm night guy. I stay up as late as I want. So you get up in the morning, you're exhausted, you're groggy. Ooh, I hate that night guy. See, night guy always screws morning guy. That's a good example of how we struggle in the present to take care of our future self. Night Jerry is always going to want to stay up late. And if Morning Jerry has no say in the decision, Night Jerry will get his way regardless of what's in Jerry's longer-term best interest. When we make in-the-moment decisions and don't ponder the past or future, we are more likely to be irrational and impulsive. Of course, being in deliberative mind is no guarantee of rationality. As I've noted regarding Dan Kahan's work on motivated reasoning, people performing complicated tasks with statistics, clearly a deliberative or system 2 type task, were susceptible to reasoning to make the math come out consistent with their prior beliefs. And the people with the most math skill had the strongest tendency to do that. Daniel Kahneman has also recognized that system 2 should not be considered immune to bias. We are capable of all kinds of irrationality in deliberative mind. If we get out of reflexive mind, however, we can reduce the likelihood of emotionally driven decisions and decrease the influence of bias through self-reflection and vigilance. One way to do this is to take advantage of mental time travel strategies. This tendency we have to favor our present self at the expense of our future self is called temporal discounting. We are willing to take an irrationally large discount to get a reward now instead of waiting for a bigger reward later. An example of temporal discounting among adults includes a study from the military drawdown in the 1990s that led tens of thousands of military employees to choose lump sum retirement payments at drastically discounted rates instead of guaranteed annuity payments. The men and women of the U.S. military took lump sum payments worth $2.5 billion, a 40% discount compared to the present value of the annuity payments they would have received. When Night Jerry stays up late, it's because it benefits him now. He discounts the benefits that come later from going to bed. Saving for retirement is a temporal discounting problem. The gratification of spending discretionary income is immediate. Putting it away for retirement means we have to wait decades to get enjoyment from that money. We are built for temporal discounting, for using the resources that are available to us now, as opposed to saving them for a future version of us that we aren't particularly in touch with in the moment of the decision. Time traveling can get us in touch with that future version of us. It can get future us to remind present us, hey, don't discount, or at least, don't discount so much. When we think about the past and the future, we engage deliberative mind, improving our ability to make a more rational decision. When we imagine the future, we don't just make it up out of whole cloth. Inventing a future based on nothing that we have never seen or experienced. Our vision of the future, rather, is rooted in our memories of the past. The future we imagine is a novel reassembling of our past experiences. Given that, it shouldn't be surprising that the same neural network is engaged when we imagine the future as when we remember the past. Thinking about the future is remembering the future. Putting memories together in a creative way to imagine a possible way things might turn out. Those brain pathways include the hippocampus, a key structure for memory, and the prefrontal cortex, which controls system 2, deliberative decision making. It is our cognitive control center. By engaging those pathways, Night Jerry can access memories like oversleeping and missing appointments or dozing off during morning meetings that he can use to imagine how tired Morning Jerry will be or what's going to happen to Morning Jerry's schedule when he doesn't want to get up or how his day will go when he can't pay attention. Wouldn't it be great if Morning Jerry could travel back in time and tap Night Jerry on the shoulder to tell him to go to bed? As it turns out, there's an app for that. From advancements in photo techniques and virtual reality, there is software that can show you a prediction of what you will look like decades into the future. If you feel, like most adults, bad about seeing your parents age, these images of future you can be unsettling, like looking into a sadist-designed funhouse mirror. Fortunately, they found ways to put this age progression technology to more productive uses than just making us stare into the void of our own mortality. Saving for retirement is a Night Jerry versus Morning Jerry problem. If Night Jerry isn't even thinking ahead to tomorrow morning, he's certainly not thinking ahead several decades to retirement. Retirement planning involves a series of decisions in which our present self can act to the detriment or benefit of our future self. When we set retirement goals, we are necessarily thinking about our future self's goals. How much we need to save for that older version of us to live comfortably. Our spending decisions, however, don't seem to be particularly focused on what's best for our 70-year-old self. In fact, a quick Google search on the topic quickly reveals that our retirement savings are dangerously low. According to one study by the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, roughly half of today's working households will not be able to maintain their standard of living in retirement. Depending on which estimate you read, the shortfall could be $6.8 to $14 trillion. Several organizations and companies with an interest in encouraging retirement planning have resources that allow clients to, quote-unquote, meet their future selves as they make retirement decisions. In the simplest versions of these tools, clients plug in their age, income, savings practices, and retirement goals. The apps then show the client the financial situation and lifestyle their future self can expect compared with the present. Prudential Retirement, AARP, and others have versions of these apps that emphasize the consequences of retirement planning by visually introducing us to our future self. Bank of America Merrill Lynch in 2012 for web access computing and 2014 for mobile devices introduced Merrill Edge, which includes a tool called Face Retirement. Customers upload a picture of themselves and get to see, according to a press release, quote, a lifelike 3D animation of their future self, enabling them to envision every wrinkle they could encounter at retirement age and beyond, end quote. Night Jerry gets a glimpse of what Morning Jerry looks like without enough sleep to function. This idea that seeing our aged future self could help us make better allocation decisions is based in part on research by Jeremy Balanson and Laura Karstensen of Stanford University. They used immersive virtual reality technology in a lab setting to demonstrate how a visit from Morning Jerry can help Night Jerry make better decisions. Subjects entered a virtual reality environment, after which they were asked to allocate $1,000 among accounts for various purposes, one of which was a hypothetical retirement account. Subjects seeing a digital representation of their present self in the mirror allocated an average of $73.90 to the retirement account. Other subjects looking in that mirror saw an age-progressed version of themselves. This latter group of subjects, on average, allocated $178.10 to the retirement account. This is a startling example of how future us can act as an effective decision buddy for present us. Bringing our future self into the decision gets us started thinking about the future consequences of those in-the-moment decisions. Fundamentally, Morning Jerry and Night Jerry are living the same life, and getting Morning Jerry into Night Jerry's face will remind him of that. Seeing our aged self in the mirror, along with a spreadsheet showing us how future us has to struggle to get by, is a persuasive reminder to put aside some discretionary spending money for retirement. It's that tap on the shoulder from our future self. Hey, don't forget about me. I'm going to exist, and I'd like you to please take that into account. We're not perfectly rational when we ponder the past or the future and engage deliberative mind. But we are more likely to make choices consistent with our long-term goals when we can get out of the moment and engage our past and future selves. We want Night Jerry and Morning Jerry colliding on the decision of when to get some sleep. We want all those Marty McFlys to get the additional perspective of all the other Marty McFlys. And we want our aged, wrinkly self colliding with us when we decide between spending more money now on something like a nicer car versus saving more money for retirement. Moving regret in front of our decisions. Philosophers agree that regret is one of the most intense emotions we feel, but they have argued about whether it is productive or useful. Nietzsche said that remorse was, quote, adding to the first act of stupidity, a second, end quote. Thoreau, on the other hand, praised the power of regret. Quote, make the most of your regrets. Never smother your sorrow, but tend and cherish it till it comes to have a separate and integral interest. To regret deeply is to live afresh, end quote. The problem isn't so much whether regret is an unproductive emotion. It's that regret occurs after the fact instead of before. As Nietzsche points out, regret can do nothing to change what has already happened. We just wallow in remorse about something over which we no longer have any control. But if regret occurred before a decision instead of after, the experience of regret might get us to change a choice likely to result in a bad outcome. Then we could embrace Thoreau's view and harness the power of regret because it would serve a valuable purpose. It would be helpful then if we could get regret to do some time traveling of its own, moving before our decisions instead of after them. That way, regret might be able to keep us from making a bad bet. In addition, it wouldn't, as Nietzsche implied, rear its head later by causing us to make a remorse-fueled second mistake. Morning Jerry regretted Night Jerry's decision to stay up late, but it was too late for him to do anything about it. When we see the retirement savings shortfall in this country, there is no doubt that many of the future retired versions of us are going to regret the financial allocation decisions that younger us made after it is too late to fix it. The age progression imaging works to address this issue of regret occurring when it's already too late. By giving us a look at the retirement-aged version of ourselves, it gives us the chance to experience some regret that we didn't plan adequately for retirement before we've made inadequate plans. This was one of the purposes of my loss limit in poker. Because of the loss limit agreement I had made with myself and my group, I ran the conversation in my head that I'd be forced to have when I explained why I kept playing beyond my limit. It gave me a chance to regret the decision before I bought more chips. One of our time travel goals is to create moments like that, where we can interrupt an in-the-moment decision and take some time to consider the decision from the perspective of our past and future. We can then create a habit routine around these decision interrupts to encourage this perspective taking, asking ourselves a set of simple questions at the moment of the decision, designed to get future us and past us involved. We can do this by imagining how future us is likely to feel about the decision, or by imagining how we might feel about the decision today if past us had made it. The approaches are complementary. Whether you choose to travel to the past or travel to the future depends solely on what approach you find most effective. Business journalist and author Susie Welch developed a popular tool known as 10-10-10 that has the effect of bringing future us into more of our in-the-moment decisions. Quote, every 10-10-10 process starts with a question. What are the consequences of each of my options in 10 minutes, in 10 months, in 10 years, end quote. This set of questions triggers mental time travel that cues that accountability conversation, also encouraged by a truth-seeking decision group. We can build on Welch's tool by asking the questions through the frame of the past. How would I feel today if I had made this decision 10 minutes ago, 10 months ago, 10 years ago? Whichever frame we choose, we draw on our past experiences, including similar decisions we may have regretted, in answering the questions, recruiting into the decision those less reactive brain pathways that control executive functioning. In poker, because the decisions are all made in the moment and the consequences are big and immediate, routines like 10-10-10 are a survival skill. I recognized in poker that in the same way that I was not the best judge of how I was playing after losing a certain amount of money, I was also not the best judge of the quality of my poker after 6 to 8 hours of play. Just as we can convince ourselves we are sober enough to drive, it is easy for poker players to convince themselves that they are alert enough to keep playing after many hours of intense, intellectually taxing work. In my more rational moments, away from the tables, I knew I would be better off if I played just 6 to 8 hours per session. When I reached that point in a session and considered continuing past that time limit, I could use a 10-10-10-like strategy to recruit my past and future self. How have I felt when I kept playing in the past? How has it generally worked out? When I look back, do I feel I was playing my best? This routine of asking myself these questions help mitigate the in-the-moment risk that, as I was losing my mental edge, I might try to convince myself that the game was so great that I had to keep playing. Moving regret in front of a decision has numerous benefits. First, obviously, it can influence us to make a better decision. Second, it helps us treat ourselves, regardless of the actual decision, more compassionately after the fact. We can anticipate and prepare for negative outcomes. By planning ahead, we can devise a plan to respond to a negative outcome instead of just reacting to it. We can also familiarize ourselves with the likelihood of a negative outcome and how it will feel. Coming to peace with a bad outcome in advance will feel better than refusing to acknowledge it, facing it only after it has happened. After-the-fact regret can consume us. Like all emotions, regret initially feels intense but gets better with time. Time travel strategies can help us remember that the intensity of what we feel now will subside over time. And that helps reduce the emotion we feel in the moment, making it less likely that we will prove Nietzsche right and add a second act of stupidity to the first. A flat tire, the ticker, and a zoom lens. Imagine you are standing on a narrow strip of concrete on the shoulder of a highway. Behind you is your car, hazard lights flashing. The rear tire on the driver's side is shredded. It is fully dark, and the drizzle has turned into a cold, heavy downpour. You've called roadside assistance twice, and both times, after long hold times, spoken with operators who've told you someone will arrive as soon as they get there after responding to your call. You decide to change the tire yourself, only to discover you have no jack. You're soaked to the skin and cold. How does that feel? It likely feels like the worst moment of your life. You are likely bemoaning how unlucky you are, wondering why these things always happen to you. You are miserable, and you can't imagine feeling any other way. That's how it feels in the moment. But if the flat tire had happened a year ago, do you think it would have an effect on your happiness today? Or your overall happiness over the past year? Not likely. It likely wouldn't cause your overall happiness to tick up or down. It would probably have faded to a funny story, or a story you try to make sound funny, told at cocktail parties. In our decision-making lives, we aren't that good at taking this kind of perspective, at accessing the past and future to get a better view of how any given moment might fit into the scope of time. It just feels how it feels in the moment, and we react to it. We want to create opportunities to take the broader perspective prior to making decisions driven by the magnified feelings we have in the moment. A 10-10-10 strategy does that, getting us to imagine the decision or outcome in the perspective of the past and the future. The flat tire isn't as awful as it seems in the moment. This kind of time travel strategy calms down the in-the-moment emotions we have about an event, so we can get back to using the more rational part of our brain. Recruiting past us and future us in this way activates the neural pathways that engage the prefrontal cortex, inhibiting emotional mind and keeping events in more rational perspective. This discourages us from magnifying the present moment, blowing it out of proportion and overreacting to it. This overestimation of the impact of any individual moment on our overall happiness is the emotional equivalent of watching the ticker in the financial world. We make a long-term stock investment because we want it to appreciate over years or decades. Yet there we are, watching a downward tick over a few minutes, consumed by imagining the worst. What's the volume? Is it heavier than usual? Better check the news stories. Better check the message boards to find out what rumors are circulating. A stock like Berkshire Hathaway reveals why ticker watching isn't a particularly productive endeavor when you're investing for the long run. If you refer to the various charts included in the PDF of Berkshire's performance since 1964, you'll see first that the stock has well outperformed the S&P 500. But if you zoom in on a random day in late January 2017, the upticks and downticks look large and potentially frightening. You can imagine sitting at the low point around 11:30 a.m., feeling like your losses are spiraling. And if you zoomed in on the performance of Berkshire Hathaway stock during the banking crisis, September 2008 to March 2009, you would feel terrible most days. Yet we know from the first chart, the big picture, that all those minute-to-minute and even day-to-day changes had little effect on the investment's general upward trajectory. Our problem is that we're ticker watchers of our own lives. Happiness, however we individually define it, is not best measured by looking at the ticker, zooming in and magnifying moment by moment or day by day movements. We would be better off thinking about our happiness as a long-term stock holding. We would do well to view our happiness through a wide-angle lens, striving for a long, sustaining upward trend in our happiness stock, so it resembles the first Berkshire Hathaway chart. Mental time travel makes this kind of perspective possible. We can use our past and future selves to pull us out of the moment and remind us when we're watching the ticker, looking at our lives through that lens on extreme zoom. When we view these upticks and downticks under the magnification of that in-the-moment zoom lens, our emotional responses are similarly amplified. Like the flat tire in the rain, we are capable of treating things that will have little effect on our long-term happiness as having significant impact. Our decision-making becomes reactive, focused on offloading negative emotions or sustaining positive emotions from the latest change in the status quo. We can see how this can result in self-serving bias, fielding outcomes to offload the negative emotions we feel in the moment from a bad outcome by blaming them on luck, and sustaining the positive emotions we feel from good outcomes by taking credit for them. The decisions driven by the emotions of the moment can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, degrading the quality of the bets we make, increasing the chances of bad outcomes, and making things worse. Yeah, but what have you done for me lately? Watching the ticker doesn't just magnify what has happened in the very recent past. It distorts our view of it as well. To understand the additional element of distortion, the casino is a great place to look. Imagine that you go to a casino for an evening of blackjack with your friends. In the first half hour, you go on a winning streak and are ahead $1,000. You keep playing because you and your friends are having such a good time. For the next hour and a half, it seems like you never win a hand. You lose back the $1,000 and break even for the night. How are you feeling about that? Now imagine that you lose $1,000 in the first half hour and stick around playing with your friends because they are having such a great time. In the next hour and a half, you go on a winning streak that erases the early loss, and you end up breaking even for the night. How are you feeling about that? I'm guessing you're pretty sad and morose about starting off with the big win, only to break even. In the second example, you're probably so happy that the drinks are on you. While you took a different path to get there, in both cases, you didn't win or lose a dime at the end of the 2 hours. But in one case, you're really sad about the result, and in the other, really happy. As they say in the infomercial world, but wait, there's more. Imagine you got up that same $1,000 in the first half hour, but now, over the next hour and a half, you can't seem to win a hand and you lose $900 back, ending the night with a $100 win. How does that feel? Now imagine that you lost that same $1,000 in the first half hour, but then went on a winning streak to end the night down only $100. How does that feel? Most likely, you're pretty glum about the $100 win, but still buying drinks for everyone after recovering from that terrible start to only lose $100. So you're sad that you won $100 and happy that you lost $100. The way we field outcomes is path dependent. It doesn't so much matter where we end up as how we got there. What has happened in the recent past drives our emotional response much more than how we are doing overall. That's how we can win $100 and be sad and lose $100 and be happy. The zoom lens doesn't just magnify, it distorts. This is true whether we are in a casino, making investment decisions, in a relationship, or on the side of the road with a flat tire. If we got a big promotion last week and have a flat tire right now, we are cursing our lives, complaining about how unlucky we are. Our feelings are not a reaction to the average of how things are going. We feel sad if we are breaking even or winning on an investment that used to be valued much higher. In relationships, even small disagreements seem big in the midst of the disagreement. The problem in all these situations and countless others is that our in-the-moment emotions affect the quality of the decisions we make in those moments. and we are very willing to make decisions when we are not emotionally fit to do so. Now imagine if you had gone for that night of blackjack a year ago. When you think about the outcomes as having happened in the distant past, it is likely your preference for the results reverses, landing in a more rational place. You are now happier about the $100 win than about the $100 loss. Once we pull ourselves out of the moment through time-traveling exercises, we can see these things in proportion to their size, free of the distortion caused by whether the ticker just moved up or down. This is a constant challenge in poker. While the moving scoreboard has the upside of reminding players that all their decisions have consequences, there is also a downside. The scoreboard, like a stock ticker, reflects the most recent changes, creating a risk that players get caught up in ticker watching, responding emotionally and disproportionately to momentary fluctuations. Poker players think about this problem a lot. Tilt. Surfers have more than 20 terms to describe different kinds of waves. The reason is that the type of wave, the way it breaks, the direction it's coming from, the bottom depth, etc., create differing challenges for surfers. There are closeouts, waves that break all at once, and double-ups, a type of wave created when two waves meet to form one wave, and reforms, a wave that will break, then die down, then break again. Non-surfers just call all of these waves. On rare occasions when we non-surfers need to be more specific, we just add a lot of extra words. Those extra words don't cost us much because it doesn't come up very often, maybe never. But for people involved in specialized activities, it's worth it to be able to communicate a complex concept in a single word that lay people would need lengthy phrases to convey. Having a nuanced, precise vocabulary is what jargon is all about. It's why carpenters have at least a dozen names for different kinds of nails, and in the field of neuro-oncology, there are more than 120 types of brain and central nervous system tumors. Because poker players are in a constant struggle to keep in-the-moment fluctuations in perspective, their jargon has a variety of terms for the concept that bad outcomes can have an impact on your emotions that compromise your decision-making going forward so that you make emotionally charged, irrational decisions that are likely to result in more bad outcomes that will then negatively impact your decision-making going forward, and so on. The most common is tilt. Tilt is the poker player's worst enemy, and the word instantly communicates to other poker players that you are emotionally unhinged in your decision-making because of the way things turned out. And tilt doesn't just result from bad outcomes, although that is the more likely impetus. Poker players also talk about winner's tilt, where a series of good outcomes distorts decision-making, particularly in causing a player to play as if their win rate is not a momentary fluctuation from the mean, but will continue at that rate in the future. In the euphoric, in-the-moment feeling of a big uptick, winners can make irrational in-game decisions or overestimate their level of skill and accomplishment, and commit themselves to play for higher stakes. If you blow some recent event out of proportion and react in a drastic way, you're on tilt. The concept of tilt comes from traditional pinball machines. To keep players from damaging the machines by lifting them to alter the course of the ball, the manufacturers place sensors inside that disabled the machine if it was violently jostled. The flipper stopped working, the lights went off, and the word tilt flashed in numerous places on the layout. The origin of tilt in pinball is apt because what's going on in our brain in the moments of tilt is like a shaken pinball machine. When the emotional center of the brain starts pinging, the limbic system, specifically the amygdala, shuts down the prefrontal cortex. We light up, then we shut down our cognitive control center. There are emotional and physiological signs of tilt. In poker, you can hear a player on tilt from several tables away. Every several hands, you hear a raised voice in an incredulous tone. Seriously? Again? Or, I don't even know why I bother playing. I should just hand over all my money. Imagine this, often including a lot of swearing. Along with these verbal cues, there are physiological signs of tilt. We can feel our cheeks flush and our heart race. Our respiration speeds up. Tilt, of course, is not just limited to poker. Any kind of outcome has the potential for causing an emotional reaction. We can be tempted to make a reactive, emotional decision in a disagreement with a relationship partner, or because of bad service in a restaurant, or a comment in the workplace, or making a sale only to have it canceled, or having an idea dismissed. We've all had this experience in our personal and professional lives, blowing out of proportion a momentary event because of an in-the-moment emotional reaction. By recognizing in advance these verbal and physiological signs that ticker watching is making us tilt, we can commit to develop certain habit routines at those moments. We can pre-commit to walk away from the situation when we feel the signs of tilt, whether it's a fight with a spouse or child, aggravation in a work situation, or losing at a poker table. We can take some space till we calm down and get some perspective, recognizing that when we are on tilt, we aren't decision fit. Aphorisms like take 10 deep breaths and why don't you sleep on it capture this desire to avoid decisions while on tilt. We can commit to asking ourselves the 10-10-10 questions, or things like, what's happened to me in the past when I felt this way? Or do I think it's going to help me to be in this state while I'm making decisions? Or we can gain perspective by asking how or whether this will have a real effect on our long-term happiness. If you are part of a truth-seeking pod, that pod can incorporate questions designed to sniff out tilt and reduce the number of decisions we execute while on tilt. We can incorporate vigilance around ticker watching when evaluating each other's decisions, including the most obvious question, do you think maybe you are or were on tilt? We can follow that with time traveling questions like, do you think this will really matter in the long run? If we make the concept of tilt and its negative impact on decision quality part of the discussion, it creates accountability around tilt to the group. Ignoring the signals of emotional decision-making raises the prospect of having to answer for it. That, in turn, will get us positive reinforcement from the group for recognizing the signs of tilt and avoiding decision-making in that state. It also trains good habits of mind, so we can run these processes on our own, acting as our own decision buddy. At the very beginning of my poker career, I heard an aphorism from some of the legends of the profession. It's all just one long poker game. That aphorism is a reminder to take the long view, especially when something big happened in the last half hour or the previous hand, or when we get a flat tire. Once we learn specific ways to recruit past and future versions of us to remind ourselves of this, we can keep the most recent upticks and downticks in their proper perspective. When we take the long view, we're going to think in a more rational way. Ulysses contracts, time traveling to pre-commit. The most famous traveler of antiquity, the Homeric hero Odysseus, was also a mental time traveler. One of the legendary trials on his journey home involved the island of the Sirens. Sailors passing the island became so entranced by the siren's song that they would steer toward the shore, crashing to their deaths on the rocky shoal around the island. Aware of the fate that befell any sailor who heard the song, Odysseus told his crew to tie his hands to the mast and fill their ears with beeswax as they approached the island. They could then steer safely, unaffected by the song they could not hear, while he would get to hear the siren song without imperiling the ship. The plan worked perfectly. This action, past us preventing present us from doing something stupid, has become known as a Ulysses contract. Most translations of Homer use the hero's ancient Greek name, Odysseus. The time travel strategy uses the hero's ancient Roman name, Ulysses. It's the perfect interaction between past you, present you, and future you. Ulysses recognized that his future self, along with his crew, would become entranced by the sirens and steer toward the rocks. So he had his crew fill their ears with wax and tie his hands to the mast, literally binding his future self to better behavior. One of the simplest examples of this kind of contract is using a ride-sharing service when you go to a bar. A past version of you who anticipated that you might decide irrationally about whether you are okay to drive has bound your hands by taking the car keys out of them. Most illustrations of Ulysses contracts, like the original, involve raising a barrier against irrationality. But these kinds of pre-commitment contracts can also be designed to lower barriers that interfere with rational action. For example, if we are trying to eat healthier, we might identify that an irrational decision point occurs when we go to the mall with someone, agree to meet them in a couple hours, and spend idle time in the food court. A barrier-inducing Ulysses contract could involve us not going to the mall at all, or budgeting our time tightly so we have just enough time to accomplish our intended purpose. A barrier-reducing contract would be to pre-commit to carry healthy snacks in our bag so we can increase the probability, if we're doing any idle eating, that we can make a better choice since we have drastically reduced the effort it takes to grab a healthier snack. Ulysses contracts can come in varying levels of how much your hands are bound, ranging from physically preventing acting on a decision to just committing in advance to certain actions without any barriers, save the commitment itself. Regardless of the level of binding, pre-commitment contracts trigger a decision interrupt. At the moment when we consider breaking the contract, when we want to cut the binding, we are much more likely to stop and think. When you are physically prohibited from deciding, you are interrupted in the sense that you are prevented from acting on an irrational impulse. The option simply isn't there. That's the brute force way to do this kind of time traveling. Past Ulysses interrupted present Ulysses' decision by taking the decision literally out of his hands. In most situations, you can't make a pre-commitment that's 100% tamper-proof. The hurdles aren't necessarily high, but they nevertheless create a decision interrupt that may prompt us to do the bit of time travel necessary to reduce emotion and encourage perspective and rationality in the decision. A lawyer attending a settlement negotiation can make a pre-commitment with the client or other lawyers on their team as to the lowest amount they would accept in a settlement or the highest amount they would agree to pay to settle. Home buyers, understanding that in the moment they may get emotionally attached to a home, can commit in advance to their budget. Once they decide on a house they want to buy, they can decide in advance what the maximum amount is they'd be willing to pay for it, so that they don't get caught up in the moment of the bidding. Throwing out all the junk food in our house makes it impossible for midnight us to easily, mindlessly, down a pint of ice cream. But as long as we have a car or food delivery services, that kind of food is still available somewhere. It just takes a lot more effort to get to it. The same is true if we ask the waiter not to put the bread basket on the table at the restaurant. We can still obviously get bread, but now we have to ask the waiter to bring it. In fact, even Ulysses had to rely on his crew to ignore him if, upon hearing the siren song, he signaled them to free him. Ulysses contracts can help us in several ways to be more rational investors. When we set up an automatic allocation from our pay into a retirement account, that's a Ulysses contract. We could go through the trouble of changing the allocation, but setting it up initially gives our goal setting, System 2 self, a chance to pre-commit to what we know is best for our long-term future. And if we want to change the allocation, we have to take some specific steps to do so, creating a decision interrupt. Investment advisors do this with clients, determining in advance, as they are discussing the client's goals, the conditions under which they would buy, sell, hold, or press their positions on particular stocks. If the client later wants to make an emotional decision in the moment, involving, for example, a sudden rise or drop in the value of an investment, the advisor can remind the client of the discussion and the agreement. In all these instances, the pre-commitment or pre-decision doesn't completely bind our hands to the mast. An emotional, reactive, irrational decision is still physically possible, though to various degrees more difficult. The pre-commitments, however, provide a stop-and-think moment before acting, triggering the potential for deliberative thought. Will that prevent an emotional, irrational decision every time? No. Will we sometimes still decide in a reflexive or mindless way? Of course. But it will happen less often. Decision swear jar. We all know about the concept of a swear jar. If someone swears, they put a dollar in the jar. The idea behind it is that it will make people more mindful about swearing and reduce how much they do it. A decision swear jar is a simple kind of pre-commitment contract that we can apply to many of the key concepts in this book. For the decision swear jar, we can identify the language and thinking patterns that signal we are veering from our goal of truth-seeking. When we find ourselves using certain words,